snugly lunching behind the deal boarding into eternity. An alternative method, assassination in its more traditional character, would be to shoot Hitler as he passed through the restaurant and hope his inattentive bodyguards were too slow to intervene. The only problem with this second plan was that it was suicidal. Ursula and Burton shared the conviction that killing Hitler was not only possible, but a moral imperative. Neither of us believed in the effectiveness of terrorist attacks on individuals, she wrote, but there were some people we considered so dangerous and bestial that we were prepared to break the rules. Foote was not nearly so keen. He too wanted Hitler dead. He just didn't want to die himself. Burton might be a stranger to fear, but Foote was not. The next day they practiced assembling bombs, and Ursula gave her accomplices an initial lesson in wireless technology. How very different were these two Englishmen, Ursula reflected. Len was intelligent, well-read, and a keen observer, but he did not possess Jim's self-assured poise. Foote was resourceful and shrewd, with a talent for organisation, but she also detected a tendency towards cynicism and a taste for the high life. He seemed to be having rather too good a time in Germany. Burton liked to wander alone in the mountains, whereas Foote was happiest in the flesh pots of Geneva. I preferred the sensitive Len, she wrote, who loved nature and took an interest in my children. Franz Obermanns, the deputy Ursula had been introduced to in Moscow, arrived in Switzerland several months later than expected. During training, the young German communist had set off a bomb prematurely and gashed his chin with flying glass. The centre insisted he would be too conspicuous in Switzerland, with a face swathed in bandages, so he had delayed his departure until the wound healed. Ursula met him in Bern and instructed him to find lodgings in Freiburg in western Switzerland, build a transmitter, watch for any signs of surveillance, and await developments. Obermanns did not inspire confidence. He was enthusiastic enough, but still had a vivid red scar on his face, not exactly an advantage in secret work. He seemed clumsy. By the summer of 1939, Ursula had two working transmitter receivers, two agents embedded in Germany, a willing assistant in Obermanns, and a plan to blow up the Führer. To finance operations, Moscow transferred funds into a London bank account, disguising the origin, which she withdrew as required. The centre was pleased. Major Sonya's Swiss network was running like clockwork, and war was on the horizon. In March, German troops had occupied Prague, the same month that Austria was annexed by Nazi Germany. Franco's nationalists were supreme in Spain. Would it be Switzerland's turn next? Ursula wondered. Foreigners were already fleeing the country, fearful of a Nazi invasion. The Nazis had two separate intelligence organizations operating in Switzerland. The Abwehr, military intelligence, and Heinrich Himmler's powerful Reich Security Main Office, or RSHA, which combined the Gestapo and the Sicherheitsdienst, SD, the SS intelligence service. German spy hunters were combing Switzerland for enemies of the Reich. Geneva was swarming with secret agents from many countries, and the Gestapo men came in droves, wrote Ursula. Her German passport, issued in Shanghai in 1935, would expire in May 1940, and as a Jew stripped of citizenship, she was ineligible for a new one. Without a passport and residence permit, she was liable to be deported, tantamount to a death sentence. Horrific accounts of what was happening to Jews in Germany were already circulating in Geneva. Marie Ginsburg, the librarian at the League of Nations, was a Polish Jew active in the underground network smuggling Jews out of Germany on false passports. She offered to help. For 2,000 Swiss francs, a Bolivian diplomat in Bern could provide Ursula with a Bolivian passport. It was some protection, but not much. What Ursula needed was legal citizenship of another country, and a genuine passport to get her out of Switzerland in a hurry if the Nazis marched in. Olga Moot returned from the village one afternoon bearing a worrying rumour. Jews with expired passports would be put over the German border. Ursula downplayed the danger. There are many people without passports, and the deportations can only be isolated cases. Ollo was unconvinced. If they find out anything about your work, it will be your turn. You know what will happen to you under Hitler. You won't survive. But then the German nanny brightened. I promise you one thing. I will keep the children with me even if I have to hide them. When they send me back to Germany, I will take them with me. With their blue eyes and blonde hair, they won't attract attention. I can earn enough for the three of us. You won't need to worry about them. They'll have a good time with me. Ursula did not like the direction this conversation was taking and brusquely put a stop to it. I am still alive. My work may not be discovered, and even if they do arrest me, they may not hand me over. Olga Moot had intended to be reassuring, but her words carried a peculiar chill. The nanny had already framed a plan. Should Ursula die, for adopting and raising the children herself, back in Nazi Germany. Chapter 13. A Marriage of Convenience. On the 23rd of August 1939, the foreign ministers of Germany and the Soviet Union signed a diplomatic agreement in Moscow, and Ursula's political universe imploded. Under the deal agreed by Joachim von Ribbentrop and Vyacheslav Molotov, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union, hitherto sworn enemies, pledged not to attack one another. In a secret protocol attached to the Non-Aggression Pact, they simultaneously agreed to carve up into German and Soviet spheres of influence Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Finland. This was power politics at its most cynical. A calculation by both sides that, for the moment, they had more to gain from non-belligerence than conflict. Hitler privately believed that war with the Soviet Union was inevitable, and he would make it so. But the Führer, whom Ursula had so recently plotted to assassinate with the full approval of the Red Army, was no longer the enemy. The day after the signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, Ursula received a radio message from Major Vera Polyakova at the centre. Cease all activities against Germany. Pull all agents out and break all contact with any remaining resident agents. Ursula was shocked to the core. Without warning, Moscow had suspended offensive operations against the regime that had forced her family into exile, destroyed the German Communist Party, and begun the systematic slaughter of her fellow Jews. She had fought fascism all her adult life, in Germany, China, Manchuria, Poland, and now Switzerland. She had repeatedly risked her life for the Soviet Union. And now communism, the cause she loved, was in league with Nazism, the creed of racist violence and death she detested. Ursula had never experienced such a crisis of political conscience. Stalin's purges had exposed the brutality at the core of the regime, but she had told herself this was the result of individual mistakes. The Nazi-Soviet pact was a betrayal. For months, rumours had been circulating in Geneva that Germany and Moscow were in secret talks, but Ursula had dismissed this as journalistic gossip. Throughout the trials of her early life, she had been sustained by a belief that the party, directed by Moscow, was infallible. In time, Ursula would parrot the myth that the Non-Aggression Pact had been a necessary temporary truce, stymieing a Western capitalist plot to lure Nazi Germany and the USSR into a war of mutual destruction. In truth, like most intelligent communists of the time, she knew Hitler represented the polar opposite of everything she believed in, and Stalin had chosen, for reasons of expediency, to make peace with him. She was devastated, deeply disillusioned, and she was not alone. The Nazi-Soviet pact was greeted with dismay by communist parties worldwide and with horror by Jews everywhere. It surprised Germany's allies, including Japan, and galvanized her enemies. 2 days later, Britain entered a treaty with France in defense of Poland. A day after that, the Swiss army was mobilized in anticipation of a German invasion. Caux, usually bustling with summer visitors, became a ghost town as the last tourists fled. She might have been heartbroken at Moscow's pact with the devil, but Ursula remained a disciplined Red Army officer. Alexander Foote was in Geneva when the news broke. Ursula told him to stay where he was and get word to Len Burton to leave Germany immediately and join them in Switzerland. She knew better than to defy Moscow, but she hinted at her misery in a message to the centre requesting a transfer from Switzerland to the US. The stern message came back. No more agents were needed in America. Sonia should remain at her post, await orders, and spend the time usefully training Foote and Burton to operate a shortwave radio. On the 1st of September, Germany invaded Poland. The free city of Danzig was incorporated into the Reich, and much of its communist underground wiped out overnight. Karl Hoffmann, the delicate and tubercular leader of the group Ursula had worked with, was summarily murdered and his network liquidated. Len was in Bavaria when he received Foote's telegram instructing him to get out of Germany as fast as he could. Burton crossed the border into Switzerland on the 3rd of September 1939. That day, Britain declared war on Germany. Foote and Burton checked into the Pension Elizabeth. They were the only guests, and the little spy trio hunkered down in the Swiss mountains. From the centre came an ominous silence. "During the first week of a Europe at war, we received no kind of instruction," wrote Foote. Hitherto, Ursula had not specified the source of their orders, but now that they were no longer fighting fascism, she owed her sub-agents a fuller explanation. Ursula told them her real name, described her work in China and Poland, and explained that she was an officer in the Red Army. The order to cease spying on Germany came directly from Moscow. Foote was wryly amused that all the preparatory work for assassinating Hitler had been completely wasted, but he was not unduly perturbed to discover that he was an employee of Soviet military intelligence. Ursula tried to seem unruffled by the dramatic change of Soviet policy, but they could tell she was disgusted and distraught. "The Russian-German pact," wrote Foote, "hit her like a thunderbolt out of the clear sky. Its effect on Sonia was shattering. She had always regarded the party line as being firmly and steadfastly directed against fascism. At one blow, all this was changed, and she, as a good party member, had now to regard the Nazis as her friends and the democracies as her potential foes. It was really too much for her." So began a strange period of limbo. A few days after the outbreak of war, Ursula wrote to her parents in Britain. "Now it has happened, I can hardly believe it. Strange how the sunsets are still as beautiful and peaceful as ever. It is lonely here." Every day, the two men walked up to La Taupinière for wireless tuition. Foote spent his afternoons sunbathing and his evenings in Geneva's bars and restaurants, courting the sister of the Romanian foreign minister. Ursula and Len took long walks in the countryside. Slowly, the younger Englishman opened up, describing his abandonment as a child, his conversion to radical politics, and his experiences in Spain. Len's strange life had made him oversensitive and introvert, she reflected, but there was also something special about this shy, quiet man, intelligent, brave, and with high morals. He frequently stayed for supper and played with the children before returning to the boarding house. "Moscow was leaving us severely alone," wrote Foote. Our usefulness to them was past for the moment, and the Red Army was content to allow the network to remain fallow until the time should come to revive it. Moscow had clipped our espionage wings. Ursula was going through the motions, supplying the centre with bland monthly reports on the political situation, but, as Foote observed, her heart was not in the work. That disillusionment was compounded when the Soviet Union invaded Finland in November 1939, an act of nakedly aggressive territorial expansion. Franz Obermans, Ursula's number two, was equally disenchanted. "Shocked and bewildered, we talked for hours," she wrote. The Swiss had taken to carrying out spot checks on foreigners. During one of her conversations with Obermans, a policeman appeared without warning at the front door, panting from the exertion of the climb to La Taupinière. Ursula pretended the young man with the scarred face was one of her suitors. Local gossips had noticed that men frequently called on the attractive single woman on the hillside, and the policeman departed satisfied, having inspected Obermann's false papers and noted down the name, Eriki Noki. The Nazi-Soviet pact theoretically precluded active espionage operations, but it did not prevent the Gestapo from continuing to hunt down communist spies and subversives both inside Germany and beyond her borders. Moscow maintained its support for what remained of the communist movement in Germany. In late October, Ursula was instructed to arrange collection of a large sum of money from a courier in Geneva and then transfer it across the border into Germany for Rosa Thalmann, wife of the imprisoned KPD leader, Ernst Thalmann. This was all very admirable as a gesture of international solidarity, but Ursula, Obermans, and the two Englishmen could not enter Germany without facing immediate arrest. She wondered whether to attempt the journey using Olga Mut's German passport. If things turned out badly, she could say that I had stolen it from her. But no amount of disguise could make Ursula 6 inches shorter, age her by 25 years, and turn her eyes from brown to green. Ollo agreed to make the trip herself. No one would suspect the grey-haired nanny of being a communist money mule, and she could pretend she was visiting the military orphanage where she had grown up. Ollo's principal concern was Nina. "I'm an old woman. What can happen even if it turns out badly? But the separation from my child, I wouldn't survive that." At 12 o'clock the following Sunday afternoon, Alexander Foote waited for the cash courier outside the entrance to Geneva's Botanical Gardens. As instructed, he wore a dark blue felt hat and held a furled umbrella in the crook of his right arm, a pair of leather gloves in his right hand, and a copy of the picture post in his left. The handover took less than a minute. Back at La Taupinière, Ursula prized off the back of her old clothes brush, folded the money tightly inside, and sealed it up with glue. Ollo, innocent, small, and mouse grey, set off for Germany. If the Nazis discovered what she was up to, she would not be coming back. Rosa Thalmann was initially suspicious of Nazi entrapment when an unknown woman appeared at her apartment door. But once inside, Ollo convinced her that the money would provide material aid to the starving families of other victims of Nazism. The next day, in a Berlin park, Ollo handed over the clothes brush in a bag. The two women hugged and briefly wept. "I will never forget this," said Rosa. "Everything's fine," Ollo called out as she trotted back up the path to the molehill. Ursula was relieved to see her and profoundly grateful. But as the nanny swept up the 3-year-old girl and held her tightly, Ursula could not help noticing she only had eyes for Nina. Switzerland, once a safe haven, was becoming a cage. The hunt for illegal radios intensified, and foreigners were subjected to increased Swiss surveillance. Himmler's spy hunters stepped up their pursuit. "As far as I could tell, I was not under observation," Ursula wrote. But whenever she turned on the transmitter, she wondered if this would be the last time. The Swiss banking authorities clamped down on foreign transactions, and the money from Moscow dried up. Ursula was now supporting not only her family and Ollo, but also Foote, Burton, and Obermans. The centre promised to send more money. None arrived. An officer of the Swiss Security Service appeared one morning, unannounced and inquisitive. Ursula parried his questions and then demanded, "Why does neutral, democratic Switzerland distrust Germans persecuted by Hitler instead of concentrating on German Nazis, of whom there are more than enough in this country?" The officer replied sadly, "I would be 100 times happier to do just that." The visit was unsettling. Len Burton dug a hole in the woods and laid a board covered with earth and leaves over the top, a hiding place for the transmitter in an emergency. Alexander Foote was fond of Ursula, but somewhat taken aback when she asked him to marry her. Her reasons could not have been less romantic. When her German passport expired, she would be legally unprotected, save for a fake Bolivian document. But as the wife of an Englishman, she would be eligible for British citizenship and could apply to the consulate in Geneva for a British passport. Then, if the Nazis invaded Switzerland, she could flee to London and join the rest of her family. The centre approved the plan, and Foote accepted Ursula's marriage proposal. Numerous mariages blancs, unconsummated marriages of convenience, were taking place in Switzerland at the time purely for the purpose of acquiring legal papers, he wrote. Ursula assured him that a divorce would be possible at any time. The only problem was that she was still married to Rudy, who was somewhere in China. Foote was a chancer, but he drew the line at bigamy. Again, the solution was brutally simple. Foote filled out a formal witness declaration for the Swiss divorce courts, stating that Rudolf Hamburger, present whereabouts unknown, had committed adultery with one of Sonia's sisters in a London hotel. Rudy had done no such thing, but it is probable that Foote himself had, with Brigitte. Years later, Foote made no bones at all about the perjury he had committed in the Swiss courts, but the subterfuge would come back to haunt Ursula. On the 26th of October 1939, Ursula's marriage was terminated on the grounds of Rudolf Hamburger's adultery. Seldom has a divorce ruling been more unjust. In early December, Franz Obermanns failed to turn up for a scheduled meeting in Zurich. Nor did he appear at a backup rendezvous a week later. Ursula, seriously alarmed, broke every rule by telephoning his flat in Freiburg. A voice she did not recognize said he no longer lived there. It is a mystery why the Swiss police took so long to spot something fishy about Eriki Noki, a man with a distinctive facial scar traveling on a Finnish passport issued in Canada, who spoke neither Finnish nor English. A raid on his apartment uncovered a litter of wireless parts, and Obermanns was arrested. Ursula knew that somewhere in police files was a report that Enoki had been seen at La Taupinière. That night, she and Len extracted the radio from the cupboard, wrapped the individual parts against the damp, and buried them in the woods. Henceforth, each contact with Moscow required digging up and reassembling the radio. There was no more transmitting in bed. The police swiftly established Obermann's real identity, and when the Gestapo discovered the convicted communist agitator was in Swiss custody, they issued an immediate extradition demand. This was rejected on the basis that he was already being investigated by the Swiss authorities for alleged passport violations. The unlucky spy got lucky. Obermanns would spend the rest of the war in a relatively comfortable Swiss internment camp. "The whole affair shook Sonia severely," wrote Foote. Meanwhile, Foote and Burton were getting on each other's nerves. Apart from their shared experiences in Spain, they had little in common. Burton was serious and sober, whereas Foote frequently behaved as if he was on some secret holiday, growing fat, literally and metaphorically, while Europe burned. Len complained his partner was an egoist who set too much store by pleasure. Foote was also fickle. A few weeks after the divorce came through, he told Ursula he had a confession to make. He had gone to Spain to avoid marrying a woman he had impregnated in England. If he married Ursula, this affair would be stirred up again. So he was backing out. This was both highly inconvenient and ideologically troubling. If it was true, then Foote had fought in Spain for ignoble reasons rather than political commitment. And if it was a lie, he was trying to wriggle out of a direct command from the Red Army. But Foote had an alternative suggestion. Would you consider marrying Len instead? Ursula was happy with Plan B, indeed, rather happier. Marriage to either Englishman was a passport to a passport, but she liked Len more. She put the idea to Burton, reassuring him that the marriage was strictly pro forma. You can trust me to divorce you as soon as you want. Len retorted sharply. I understand the meaning of a paper marriage perfectly well, he snapped. But he agreed nonetheless. Ursula was struck by Len's unaccustomed belligerence. His sensitivity over the bogus marriage touched her. From that moment, their friendship took on a slightly different hue. At first, she could not put her finger on it. He was strange, this withdrawn young Englishman, but there was something appealing about his combination of shyness and courage, tenderness and toughness. The Swiss might be watching them. The Germans might invade. The Gestapo, if they found them, could kill them all. But the tension and danger barely seemed to touch him. At one point, he even suggested that he volunteer to spy for the Germans in order to double-cross them, an idea as brave as it was impractical. She was moved by Len's deepening relationship with Michael and his cautious way of empathising with the boy. Olga Moot was shocked to discover Ursula was now engaged to Len Burton. I thought you were only working with him, she protested. And now he's going to live here? Ursula put a hand on the nanny's shoulder. He is a good man. He has bonded with the children. This marriage is really very important because it finally gives me a useful passport. Are we going to be free of the worry that they will catch you and dump you over the border? Ursula nodded. Then that's the only reason you're marrying him? A sham marriage? Ursula nodded again, a little less convincingly. The passport plays a part. Ollo sighed crossly and launched into a diatribe, as if ticking off a little girl. That's typical of you. First you had a man, and there couldn't have been a better one. Then suddenly you claim that you have grown apart from Rudy and bury yourself with the little one in the furthest corner of China. We were all shocked. Your mother and I had the same suspicion. There was something political behind it. The next thing we heard, you're having a child. We never even got to see the father. And now, another man. Ursula was shaken. Ollo had always been blunt and fond of Rudy, but there was something more to her beloved nanny's reaction, something darker and more dangerous. Olga Moot was not just angry. She seemed scared. Word that Frau Hamburger had become engaged to the younger of the two Englishmen spread swiftly through Co, as such news does in small communities. Though she did not know the strange subtext to the engagement, Frau Fusli, the farmer's wife, was delighted for Ursula, as was Lillian Jacobi, the elderly Jewish woman who had become a close friend. The betrothed couple took to the slopes. Ursula was now an accomplished downhill skier, but Len was a dangerous combination of intensely enthusiastic, barely competent, and completely fearless. One afternoon, they caught the little train to Rocher de Naye, 2,000 feet above sea level. The view over the valley was spectacular. They skied down fast. In Len's case, far too fast. He lost control on a steep slope, slammed into a wall of ice, and broke both his skis. They trudged home on foot through the deep snow, holding on to one another to avoid sliding. Burton laughed happily all the way down. Ursula wrote, "It dawned on me how much I liked Len." There was no romantic epiphany, no sudden tumble into love, just the slow realization that although she had told Len he could divorce her whenever he wanted, she rather hoped he never would. Burton had never experienced a home life before. Becoming part of our family, feeling warmth and care in a cheerful, harmonious atmosphere, was a decisive experience. We were comrades bound to one another through work and danger. We shared the same opinions about books and people. Every day we consciously enjoyed the beauties of the landscape. Len's understanding for the children was quite amazing. They chose a politically auspicious date for their wedding. 23rd of February, the anniversary of the founding of the Red Army, later known as Defender of the Fatherland Day. The ceremony was so low-key as to be barely audible. Two paper rings from the Uniprix in Vevey and some swift paperwork in the registry office at Geneva with the porter and clerk as witnesses. Then Mr. and Mrs. Burton went back home to La Taupinière for a pancake lunch cooked by Ollo. There is, of course, no record of when this arranged marriage ceased to be merely convenient, pro forma, and white. But it is entirely possible that it was consummated, and Len lost his virginity that very evening, in the molehill, exactly 22 years after the birth of the Red Army. Ursula Kaczynski accidentally fell in love with Len Burton, and by the most circuitous route. The fourth and enduring love of her life came about as the result of an illegal spy plot and a sham marriage. Later, they debated the precise moment their love affair had started. "When did you realise that you liked me?" she asked him. In novels, they would say love at first sight at our first illegal meeting in Vevey, outside Uniprix. "As early as that? I never had the slightest idea." "I didn't let on to myself for a long time," said Len. But Ursula had also fallen for Len earlier than she admitted. In a letter to her mother, written soon after their engagement, she explained that she intended to marry this Englishman, 7 years her junior. "I love him," she added. Many years later, Len wrote an assessment of Ursula as a wife, intelligence officer, and revolutionary. Style, elegance, restraint, modesty, and the initiative to carry the fight to the enemy, coupled with stability under stress. You may well say it is immodest to talk about one's boss and wife in such terms. Sonia was equipped with a command of the techniques of diversion, manufacture and use of explosives, theory and practice of radio communications, and the ability to teach others. She never made demands that she would not make on herself. Her dedication to the destruction of fascism was absolute. But she remained feminine and was the most devoted of mothers. Like many successful marriages, this one was not entirely straightforward. Len sometimes accused his wife of being dictatorial, which she could be, particularly in matters of professional espionage. He was never in doubt that he had married his superior officer. She found him thin-skinned and liable to sudden, inexplicable changes of mood. He fussed over things that I felt were unimportant. But Ursula provided Len with love, unconditional and absolute, something he had never known. For many years she had lived in danger and courted risk, while constantly accompanied and sometimes paralysed by fear. What Len gave Ursula, in addition to lifelong loyalty and a marriage certificate, was a byproduct of his own strange character. He lent her some of his own stolid fearlessness. Richard Sorge had offered glamour and peril. Johann Patra, the working-class seaman, was a creature from another world, jealous and competitive, an irresistibly romantic revolutionary. But Len was neither her boss nor her rival. He needed her as no one had ever needed her before, and loved her in a way that was simple, strong, and unquestioning. Ursula was no longer the headstrong adventure seeker, but a mature undercover agent and trained intelligence officer with two children, a spy network, and a heavy burden of responsibility. She no longer lived for fast motorbikes or political arguments that stretched into the early hours. She needed backup, emotional and professional. She did not want another firebrand or a sparring partner. She wanted a good husband. And she got one. Ursula applied for a British passport the day after the wedding, and the consul duly wrote to the passport office in London, asking whether he should issue one. The report came back on the 28th of March 1940. We have no record on Mrs. Ursula Burton, and only a possible trace of her ex-husband with a communistic smell. On the face of it, I do not see how you can refuse to issue a British passport. MI5 thought otherwise. The British Security Service was by now profoundly suspicious of the Kaczynski family and concerned to discover that yet another member might be en route to Britain. Fear of the Red Menace had intensified with the Nazi-Soviet pact. Both Robert and Jurgen Kaczynski had adopted the party line from Moscow and publicly condemned the war as a conflict between imperialists that communists had no stake in. Robert was described by MI5 as spreading defeatism with his anti-war attitudes. The family was deeply involved with the Free German League of Culture, which MI5 considered a communist front organisation. At the end of 1939, Jurgen Kaczynski was brought before the Aliens Tribunal, the body set up by the Home Office to rule on which of the 70,000 German and Austrian enemy aliens in Britain should be locked up as potential enemy agents. MI5 submitted evidence that he was a communist, something he did nothing to hide, and on the 20th of January 1940, Jurgen was interned at Seton Camp in Devon, a former holiday camp, along with 568 other Category A internees, most of them Nazis. Robert was designated Category C and remained at liberty, to MI5's annoyance. Everyone knows, as the judge does, that he is a real communist and professes everywhere his aversion against this imperialistic war. MI5 was equally suspicious of Len Burton, but as yet uncertain whether his sympathies lay with communism or Nazism. Burton is known to have been sufficiently interested in Germany to have bought a German grammar and German readers, and was said to be in Germany in September 1939. He was placed on the Central Security War Blacklist as a possible subversive. Jurgen Kaczynski's internment led to a tussle between MI5, which wanted him locked up, and the Home Office, which saw no reason to detain him. Numerous well-connected friends weighed in to demand Jurgen's release, insisting, wrongly, that he was completely innocent. Labour's leader, Clement Attlee, even raised the issue of Kaczynski's continued internment in the House of Commons. Lillian Bowes-Lyon, the Queen's cousin, wrote to Marguerite, sympathising over her husband's incarceration. Sir Alexander Maxwell, permanent Under-Secretary of State at the Home Office, pointed out that being a communist was not in itself a reason for internment, and insisted that unless MI5 have some reason beyond what appears in these files, Kaczynski ought to be released. Jurgen was freed on the 19th of April 1940, with a glowing commendation from the camp commandant, who described him as a very able man intellectually and a thoroughly good sort. MI5 was furious. It still had no idea just how deeply Jurgen was involved with Soviet intelligence, but nonetheless considered him to be a very dangerous person, whose sister should not be granted citizenship. MI5 tried to jam the brakes on Ursula's passport application. "We have now received further information with regard to Mrs. Ursula Burton and are strongly of the opinion that she should not be issued with a British passport." The reply came back. "We can do little now, as we authorised the issue of a passport on the 24th of April. Ursula collected the precious document from the consulate at 41 K. Wilson in Geneva. Just in time, she had acquired the means to flee Switzerland if the Nazis attacked, as they fully intended to do. A week after Ursula became a British citizen, Hitler launched his Blitzkrieg. Activated by the codename Danzig, German troops poured westward and north in an unstoppable armoured tide. Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium and Luxembourg were overrun. On the 14th of June, the Nazis occupied Paris, leaving only the southern free zone of France under Pétain's Vichy regime. German planning for the invasion of Switzerland started on the day France surrendered. Publicly, Hitler declared that At all times, whatever happens, we will respect the inviolability and neutrality of Switzerland. Privately, he prepared to incorporate the country into the Greater Reich, regarding the Swiss as a misbegotten branch of our Volk and a pimple on the face of Europe. As Ursula put it, Switzerland was encircled by the fascists. Only a single narrow passage through France remained open. Foote later claimed that Ursula and Len were too preoccupied with each other to pay much attention to international events. This was not true, but they were certainly acting like a honeymoon couple, wandering the Swiss Alps hand in hand, picking daffodils. It was perfectly obvious that this was anything but a marriage of convenience, wrote Foote, who found their blooming love affair quite amusing. Olga Moot did not. She had been assured that this marriage was one of expediency, whereas it was plainly a reality. She brooded furiously. Ollo felt a fierce residual loyalty to Rudy, who had no idea that his wife had obtained a divorce, a new husband, a new name, and a new nationality. But then, Rudolf Hamburger was hardly in a position to do anything about the situation, since he was being tortured in a Chinese jail. Chapter 14. The Baby Snatcher. Emily Hahn, the New Yorker correspondent in China, was taking cover in the bomb shelter of the Press Hotel in Chungking when military police burst in and arrested one of her fellow guests. The man pulled a gun and was disarmed after a brief struggle, but not before he had attempted to swallow a piece of paper. He was tied up and led away. It was just like the movies, Hahn wrote. Mickey Hahn had seen plenty of drama in her 35 years. A cigar-smoking adventurer from St. Louis, Missouri, she had lived with a pygmy tribe, driven across America dressed as a man in a Model T Ford, and walked alone from one side of Central Africa to the other. She arrived in Shanghai at around the time Ursula left and became notorious for smoking opium and attending dinner parties with Mr. Mills, a pet gibbon she dressed in a nappy and tailor-made dinner jacket. She was befriended by Agnes Smedley, who used Hahn's Shanghai address as a mail drop for letters she did not want intercepted by the police. After the outbreak of war between Japan and China in 1937, Hahn moved with a posse of fellow journalists to Chongqing, the wartime capital of the Chinese government under Chiang Kai-shek. The city was being pummeled by Japanese bombers. At the sound of the sirens, the international clientele of the Chungking Press Hostel, many still in their nightwear, crammed into a shelter constructed inside a cave in the garden. Here, Chinese waiters served snacks and cocktails as incendiary bombs rained down. It was during one of these gatherings that Emily Hahn witnessed the calamitous end to Rudolf Hamburger's first short-lived spy mission. It had all started so promisingly. On the 20th of April 1939, Rudy and Johann Patra boarded the Katori Maru in Marseille. The boat was packed with Jews fleeing Europe and bound for Shanghai, one of the few places in the world still open to them, as Hamburger wrote. In Shanghai, he rented a small house, while Patra took a room in the home of a wealthy Chinese family. Most of the people he and Ursula had known in the 1930s had gone, but two members of Rudy's immediate family were now resident in the city: his youngest brother, Otto, a businessman, and his widowed father, Max. There was little architectural work to be found, and so he passed his days receiving instruction from Patra on operating radios and making explosives. They got on well. Ursula was seldom discussed. Hamburger was eager to begin work as a spy, but Moscow was still in no hurry to deploy him. Finally, after twiddling his thumbs for almost a year, he was dispatched to Chungking in southwest China, with vague orders to recruit expatriate communists as informants. Patra built him a shortwave wireless, concealed inside an ordinary commercial radio, and told him to keep in touch. He sailed to Hong Kong and then flew on to Chungking on the 9th of March 1940. In the arrivals hall, Chinese police examined his luggage and confiscated the radio, telling Hamburger he could collect it in 2 days' time. A more capable spy would have fled immediately. Instead, Hamburger did as he was told. When the radio was duly returned to him without comment, he wondered how the incompetent Chinese had failed to spot the illegal transmitter concealed inside. Rather later, he realized that they knew very well that it was an espionage-grade transmitting-receiving device and were now alerted. International crises attract a peculiar congregation, and journalists, writers, entrepreneurs, and spies flocked to the Chungking Press Hostel. Hamburger was surprised to bump into Agnes Smedley, whose friendship had played such a pivotal role in Ursula's life and, by association, his. Agnes was continuing her quixotic crusade on behalf of Chinese communism, marching with the Red Army, interviewing its leaders, including Mao, writing thinly veiled propaganda for Western newspapers, and spending more time on the front line of the Chinese war than any other correspondent, male or female. She inspired devotion and irritation wherever she went. When she turned up at the Chungking Press Hostel, following another nervous breakdown and more than a year in the war zone, she was suffering from malnutrition, malaria, hives, liver damage, and possibly typhus. Her toenails and teeth were falling out, but she remained a distinctive figure, as Hahn described her, incongruous in a peach-coloured satin nightgown. Rudy knew Agnes was a spy, but Smedley was almost certainly unaware that her old friend's husband was now in the espionage game himself. Keen to start spying, Rudy Hamburger went shopping for additional radio parts. All such purchases were closely monitored by Chinese intelligence. General Dai Li, the Himmler of China, ran the National Investigation and Statistics Bureau, a secret police force dedicated to rooting out spies. Rudy was a sitting duck. Emily Hahn had spotted the soi-disant German refugee on arrival at the hotel, but made a point of avoiding the beret-wearing architect, taking him to be one of those heavily Teutonic artists from Munich. He looked the part to perfection. On the night of the 21st of April 1940, the hotel guests were milling around the shelter, shivering and yawning, as they waited for the air raid to end, when the squad of Chinese soldiers burst in. As he was seized, Rudy protested he had nothing to hide, but then somewhat undermined his assertion of innocence by brandishing a revolver, which he had no idea how to use. Hahn could not believe her eyes. He chewed up a paper and tried to swallow it. It had a code on it, exactly like the movies. Everybody was badly shaken by the scene. Hitherto we had accepted him as a perfectly pucker refugee. He didn't seem surprised at the arrest or even very indignant. "Let me get dressed, will you?" he said. The soldiers tied his hands with rope and then marched him out past all of us, standing there in our pajamas in a row, our mouths hanging out. He didn't look at any of us. We heard all sorts of stories afterward, the most reasonable of which was that he hadn't been spying for the Nazis, but for the Chinese Reds. A search of Rudy's hotel room revealed the transmitter and other incriminating items. After a night locked in a wooden shed inside the police compound, the interrogations started. Angry questions were asked. Which country or organization did I belong to? But to no avail. Rudy Hamburger might be a hopeless spy. His naivety made him totally unusable for conspiratorial activities, as his son put it. But he was preternaturally stubborn. He refused to answer questions. After 8 days, they resorted to torture. My arms were tied behind my back, and I was pulled up with a kind of pulley system on the arms about 2 feet above the ground. He was left dangling as the sinews in his shoulders slowly stretched and cracked. I found myself hanging in a rather painful position, Rudy wrote, with typical understatement. After 4 weeks of interrogation, he was driven 12 miles up the Jialing River to Bai Mansion, a large country house in the Gelashan region, a delightful valley rolling out beneath a range of pine-wooded hills. The mansion was a concentration camp and torture centre for political prisoners, surrounded with electric fences and guarded by armed patrols that shot intruders on sight. The locals called it Happy Valley. The mansion held around 50 male inmates. Hamburger was the only foreigner. His cellmate was Wong Pin Fong, a young man who spoke English and claimed to have been arrested for taking part in an illegal street protest. He had evidently been placed alongside Hamburger to find out who he was working for. Rudy treated the stool pigeon with extreme caution, but Wong reached his own accurate conclusion. In reality, you must be a member of the American or Soviet secret services, he declared. For 15 minutes every day, Hamburger was allowed to see the view from the front of the mansion through a barred window. 30 miles of lush, rolling landscape. Before he was locked up again. An ingenious form of mental torture to accompany the physical variety. Every 6 weeks, he was brought before an official and told to confess. Like every other prisoner, he contracted malaria. On a dwindling prison diet of rice, he began to waste away, physically and psychologically. How long can they hold me? He wondered. Months? Years? The country is at war, and in war, everything is possible. In June 1940, soon after the fall of France, Ursula received a message from Moscow instructing her to contact Albert, a comrade in Geneva, and put a series of questions to him. Does your office still function? What is your financial position? Can you get messages to the centre via Italy? Do you require a transmitter? The inference was clear and most surprising. There must be another Soviet spy ring operating in Switzerland, run by this mysterious Albert. As instructed, she pushed a note through the letterbox of 13 Rue de Lausanne, arranging to return in a few days' time. The man who opened the door was thick-set, verging on the plump, with dark hair, dark eyes, and a melancholy air. With his round glasses, heavy-rimmed eyes, and mournful expression, he resembled a corpulent and slightly depressed owl. "Greetings from Mr. Weber," said Ursula. The man nodded in recognition of the password, led her to an office full of books and maps, the desk strewn with papers and journals, and cleared a space for her to sit down. Ursula wondered if he might be some sort of academic. The owl took in his visitor, a tall, slender, almost fragile-looking woman in a closely fitting woolen dress. I put her age at about 35. Her movements were smooth and a trifle languid. My code name is Sonia, said Ursula with a smile. They spoke German. The director told me to get in touch with you. I was given your name and address and instructions to call on you and find out how things stand with your group. I'm supposed to report back to the director. You'll undoubtedly be receiving further instructions through me. Albert was Alexander Sandor Rado, a Jewish-Hungarian communist and an obsessive cartographic scientist by profession. He was also chief of a Soviet spy network that would become known as the Rote Drei, Red Three, the linchpin in the wider anti-Nazi espionage ring that Himmler's spy hunters dubbed the Rote Kapelle, Red Orchestra. A former commissar in the Hungarian Red Army, Rado had studied map-making in Berlin, run an entire anti-Nazi propaganda service in Austria, and fled to Paris in 1933, where he was listed by the Nazis as public enemy number one. He was recruited by the 4th Department in Moscow in 1935 and given the almost inconceivably stupid codename Dora, a simple anagram of Rado. By 1940, the rotund and unassuming Hungarian geographer was running a cartographic agency in Geneva named GeoPress, supplying maps to European newspapers. He was also the Soviet resident, the Russian term for spy chief, in Switzerland, with the rank of Major General, conducting the most important section of the Red Orchestra, a web of spies in Italy, Spain, and Switzerland, and most importantly, inside Nazi Germany. Rado typed his reports, then used microphotography to shrink them to micro dots, the size of a full stop, pasted into books, which he sent via courier to Paris, where they were enlarged, enciphered, and transmitted to Moscow by the French branch of Soviet military intelligence. The Nazi occupation of northern France had blocked this avenue of communication. As Rado put it, "I was head of an intelligence group, there was a war on, and we had no contact." "Important information is lying idle," he told Ursula. In theory, active espionage against Germany had been suspended under the Nazi-Soviet pact, but Rado's team was continuing to collect critical military intelligence. "GeoPress is a sound cover organization, and the local authorities suspect nothing," Rado told Ursula. "We are still receiving information regularly, but it is simply piling up because I have no means of passing it on to the center. We need a transmitter, trained radio operators, and a flat or house to operate from. We need a code and transmission and reception times. There are plenty of problems, as you can see, and they all need solving as a matter of urgency." "I knew precious little about Sonia," wrote Rado. "I had no idea where she lived, or whom she worked with, or what kind of intelligence she collected. The rules of conspiracy forbade me to ask her. Our two groups, Sonia's and mine, operated independently and in complete isolation until circumstances forced us to contact each other." Ursula hauled her radio out of the hole in the woods. Rado wrote up his reports in plain text on tissue paper and then drew a white cross in chalk on a street corner in Geneva. Ursula monitored the signal site before picking up the package from a dead letter box, or dead drop site, spy jargon for a secure place to leave messages. A small cavity under the railings in the hallway of the apartment opposite. She then folded the tissue paper inside a large torch, which Len had adapted by taking out one of the two batteries, rewiring it, and installing a lower wattage bulb. The torch still worked, a little dimly, while concealing several sheets of tissue. Back at La Taupinière, she enciphered the reports, transmitted them overnight to Moscow, deciphered the replies, and delivered them back to Rado at another dead letter box in Geneva. Rado's output was prodigious. Ursula felt useful again. "With so much work to do, I would have felt happy if other worries had been fewer," she wrote. Switzerland was effectively isolated from the rest of Europe, its economy deteriorating under the threat of German invasion. The Swiss government warned that if a single German soldier crossed the border, the army would destroy the country's industrial infrastructure and retreat to the mountains to fight a guerrilla war. Rado wrote, "The bitter joke made the rounds that Switzerland was now the world's largest prison. Hitler and Mussolini had completely cut off 4 million people. Only a narrow corridor near Geneva remained open to traffic through to Pétain's unoccupied zone. And it was expected that even the corridor through to Vichy France, and hence via Spain or Portugal to England or the United States, would one day be closed." Ursula's other worries were closer to home. Olga Moot's behaviour was becoming increasingly erratic. She refused to be separated from little Nina, barely spoke to Len, and bickered incessantly with Michael. Ursula wrote to her parents, "If anyone says something nice about Misha, Ollo immediately contradicts them and begins to talk about Nina." One afternoon, Ursula was idly chatting in the kitchen with her elderly friend Lillian Jacobi, while Ollo sat silently sewing in the corner. Lillian had just obtained a visa for Britain, where her son was already a refugee. She would soon be getting out of Switzerland, and urged Ursula to do the same. "You are sitting in a mousetrap that will close when the Nazis come. Don't think